Chapter 9. Jokthah. In the skins of elk I pass over grasses. Rain falls, and I cleanse my face in the sky. I hear the horse prayers spoken, but my lips are far away. I slip down weed and still twig, into their palms I pool. Then I am called out and am among them. In sorrow I rejoice. Pale, endless life, this I call my own. Anonymous, The Non-Man Canticles. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Jokthah. Somehow he awoke, more ancient. Once, while raiding the south bank in Shigek, Nayor and his men had rested their horses in the ruins of an ancient palace. Since kindling a fire was out of the question, they had unrolled their mats in the darkness beneath a ponderous section of wall. When Nayor awoke, the morning sun had bathed the limestone plains above him, and he found himself staring at figures in relief, their faces worn to serenity by the seasons, their poses at once stiff and indolent in the manner of age-old representations. And there, impossibly, at the head of a long file of captives, was a scarred arm figure kissing the heel of an outland king, a Skilvendi from another age.
"Do you know," a voice was saying, "that I actually felt pity as the last of your people perished at Kaiuth?" It was a voice that liked its own sound, very much. "No, pity isn't the right word. Regret. Regret. All the old myths collapsed at that moment. The world became weaker. I studied your people deeply, learned your secrets, your vulnerabilities. You see, even as a child, I knew I would humble you one day. And there you were, tiny figures in the distance, loping and howling like panicked monkeys, the people of war. And I thought, there's nothing strong in this world. Nothing I cannot conquer." Nayor gasped, tried to blink away the tears of pain that clotted his eyes. He lay on the ground, his arms bound so tight he could scarce feel them. A shadow leaned over him, wiped his face with a cool, wet cloth. "Who? But you," the shadow continued. It shook its head as though at an endearing yet infuriating child. "You." His eyes clearing, Nayor absorbed his surroundings. He lay in some kind of field tent, canvas panels bellied into an apex above him. A heap of blood-caked refuse lay in the far corner, his hauberk and accoutrements. A table with four camp chairs framed the man ministering to him, who had to be an officer of some kind, given the splendor of his armor and weapons. The blue mantle meant he was a general, but the bruising about his face. The man wrung rose-colored water into a copper basin set near Nayor's head. "The irony," he was saying, "is that you mean nothing in this matter. It's this Anasarimba, this false prophet, who is the sole object of the Empire's concern. Whatever significance you possess, you derive from him." A snort. "I knew this, and still I let you provoke me." The face momentarily darkened. "That was a mistake. I can see that now. What are the abuses of flesh compared with glory?" Nayor glared at the stranger. "Glory? There was no glory." "So many dead," the man said with rueful humor. "Was it you who devised that strategy? Knocking holes through walls, forcing us to chase you and your rats into your burrows? Quite remarkable. I almost wish it had been you at Kaiuth. Then I would know, wouldn't I?" He shrugged. "That's how the gods prove themselves, isn't it? The overthrow of demons." Nayor stiffened. Something involuntary thrashed through him. The man smiled. "I know you aren't human. I know that we're kin." Nayor tried to speak, but croaked instead. He ran his tongue across scabbed lips. Copper and salt. With a concerned frown, the man raised a decanter, poured blessed water into his mouth.
"Are you," Nayor rasped, "a god?"
The man stood, looked at him strangely, Points of lantern light rolled like liquid across the figures worked into his cuirass. His voice possessed a shrill edge.
I know you love me. Men often beat those they love. Words fail them, and they throw their fists into the breach. I've seen it happen many times.
Nayor rolled his head back, closed his eyes for pain. How had he come to be here? Why was he bound?
I know also, the man continued, that you hate him.
Him. There could be no mistaking the word's intensity. The Dunyain. He spoke of the Dunyain, and as though he were his enemy, no less.
You do not want, Nayor said, to raise arms against him.
And why would that be?
Nayor turned to him, blinking.
He knows the hearts of men. He seizes their beginnings and so wields their ends.
So even you, the nameless general spat, even you have succumbed to the general madness, religion.
He turned to the table, poured himself something Nayor couldn't see from the ground.
You know, Skilvendi, I thought I'd found a peer in you.
His laugh was vicious.
I even toyed with the idea of making you my exalt general.
Nayor scowled. Who was this man?
Absurd, I know. Utterly impossible. The army would mutiny. The mob would storm the Endymion Heights. But I cannot help but think that, with someone such as you, I could eclipse even Triamus.
Dawning horror.
Did you know that? Did you know you stood in the Emperor's presence?
He raised his wine bowl in salute, took a deep drink.
I curi confis the first, he gasped after swallowing. With me the Empire is reborn, Skilvendi. I am Kyrenius, I am Kine. Soon all the three seas will kiss my knee.
Blood in grimaces, roaring shouts, fire, it all came back to him, the horror and rapture of Jokthe. And then, there he was, Confus, a god with a beaten face. Nayor laughed, deep and full-throated. For a moment, the man stood dumbstruck, as though suddenly forced to reckon the dimensions of an unguessed incapacity.
You play me,
he said with what seemed genuine bafflement.
Mock me.
And Nayor understood that he'd been sincere, that Confus had meant every word he said. Of course he was baffled. He had recognized his brother. How could his brother not recognize him in turn? The chieftain of the Utamot laughed harder.
Brother, your heart is shrill and your soul is plain. Your claims are preposterous, uttered without any real understanding, like recitations of a mother's daft pride.
Nayor spat pink.
Peer, brother, you have not the iron to be my brother. You are a thing of sand. Soon you will be kicked to the wind.
Without a word, Confis strode forward, brought a sandaled heel down on his head. The world flashed dark. Nayor cackled even as the blood spilled hot across his teeth. With what seemed impossible clarity, he heard the exalt general retreat, the creak of leather about his stamped cuirass, the rasp of his scabbard across his leather skirts. The man swept aside the flap, then strode into the greater camp, already shouting names. And Nayor could feel himself slipping between immensities, the earth that pressed so cruelly against his battered frame, and the commotion of men and their fatal purposes. At last, something deep laughed within him. At last, it ends. General Sompas entered moments after, his face grim, his knife drawn. Without hesitation, he knelt at Nayor's side and began sawing through his leather bonds.
The others await,
he said in hushed tones.
Your koray is on the table.
Nayor could only reply in a cracked whisper.
Where are you taking me? To Serway.
The general had no problem leading the Skilvendi captive to the dark edge of the Nansor camp. They passed through a gallery of sentries and boisterous, celebratory camps. No one questioned the fact that the general wore a captain's uniform. They were the army of a brilliant and eccentric leader. Not once had his strange ways failed to deliver victory and vengeance, and Biaxi Sompas was his man.
Is it always this easy?
Nayor asked the creature.
Always,
it said. In the blackness beneath a stand of carob trees, Serwe and another of her brothers awaited them, along with 8 horses laden with supplies. Dawn had not yet broken when they heard the first of the horns, faint in the distance behind them. A word dogged Emperor Akuri Confis, a word he had always regarded from the outside. Terror. He sat weary, leaning against the pommel of his saddle, watching the torches bob through the dark trees before him. Sompas waited quietly to his right, as did several others. Shouts echoed through the encampment behind them. The darkness teemed with searching lights.
Skilvendi!
Confis found himself crying out to the black.
Skilvendi!
He need not look to his officers to see their questioning expressions. What was it about this man, this fiend? How had he affected him so? For all the hatred the Nansur bore toward the Skilvendi race, they were perversely enamored of them as well. There was a mystique to them, and a virility that transcended the myriad rules that so constricted the intercourse of civilized men. Where the Nansur wheedled and negotiated, the Skilvendi simply took, seized. It was as though they had embraced violence whole, while the Nansur had shattered it into 1,000 pieces to set as splinters across the multiform mosaic of their society. It made them seem more manly. And this one Skilvendi, this Utamat chieftain, Confis had witnessed it, as much as any of the columnaries who'd quailed before him in Jokha. In the firelight, the barbarian's eyes had been coals set in his skull, and the blood had painted him the color of his true skin. The swatting arms, the roaring voice, the chest-pounding declarations, they had all seen the god. They had all seen dread Gilgeol rearing about him, a great horned shadow. And now, after wrestling him to the ground like some lunatic bull, after the wonder of capturing him, capturing war, he had simply vanished. Kemen Khetri insisted no sorcery was involved, and for the first time Confis appreciated his uncle's manic suspicion of the sake. Could they have done it? Or could it be, as Kemen Khetri had nervously suggested, the faceless ones? Several of his soldiers maintained they had seen Sompas leading the Skilvendi through the camp, a rank impossibility given that Confis himself had gone to the man immediately after leaving the Skilvendi. Faceless ones, skin spies, the Mandate schoolmen had called them. Since learning from Kemen Khetri that Zarius had been murdered by one of these things, posing as his grandmother, Confis had found himself rehearsing the Mandate fool's arguments from that day in Karaskand, when they had debated the Prince of Atrathau's fate. They were not Kishorim, Confis had conceded that much. It was even more clear now that Zarius was dead. Why would the Kishorim murder the only man who might save them? They weren't Kishorim. But did that make them consult, as the Mandati had insisted? Were these truly the opening hours of the second apocalypse? Terror. How could he not be terrified? All this time, Confis had assumed that he and his uncle had stood at the root of all that happened. No matter how the others plotted, they but thrashed in the nets of his hidden designs, or so he thought. Such arrant conceit. All along, others had known, others had watched, and he hadn't the slightest inkling of their intentions. What was happening? Who ruled these events? Not Emperor Akuri Confis I. His aquiline face outlined by torchlight. Sompas looked at him expectantly, but he kept his counsel like the others. They could sense his humor, understood that it was more than merely foul. Confis scanned the moon-blanched countryside, felt the despairing twinge all men felt when confronted by the dimensions of the world that had swallowed those they desired. Were he one, were he alone, it would be hopeless. But he was not one. He was many. the ability to cede voice and limb to the will of another? Herein lay the true genius of men, the ability to kneel. With such power, Confis realized, he was no longer confined to the here and now. With such power, he could reach across the world's very curve. He was emperor. How could he not cackle? Such a wondrous life he lived. He need only make things simple, and he would start with this Skilvendi. He had no choice. That he was Skilvendi could be no coincidence. Here Confis stood on the cusp of restoring the Empire to all her past glory, only to discover that everything turned on killing a son of his ancestral enemy, the people who had overthrown the pretensions of his race time and again. He had said it himself, hadn't he? He was Kyrenius. He was Kinney. No wonder the savage had laughed. The gods were behind this. Confis was certain of it. They begrudged their brother. Like children of a different father, they resented. There was a message to this. How could there not be? He had been served some kind of warning. He was emperor now. A move had been made. The rules had been changed. Why? Why hadn't he killed the fiend? What vice or vanity had stayed his hand? Was it the iron hand clamped about his neck, the burn of the man's seed upon his back? Sompas! He fairly cried.
Yes, god of men.
How does Exalt General suit you as a title?
The ingrate swallowed.
Very well, god of men.
How he missed Martimus and the cool cynicism of his gaze.
Take the Kidrahil, all of them. Hunt down this demon for me, Sompas. Bring me his head, and that shall be your title. Exalt General, Spear of the Empire. His eyes narrowed in menace as he smiled. Fail me, and I shall burn you. Your sons, your wives, every Biaxi breathing, I shall burn you all alive.
Relying on Serwe's preternatural vision, they led their horses through the pitch of night, knowing their only advantage lay in whatever distance they could travel before sunrise. They picked their way across high scrub and grass slopes, then down into a wooded vale where the bitter of cedars braced the air. Despite his injuries, Nayor shambled after them, drawing on something as inexhaustible as lust or fear. About him, the world reeled more and more, and simple things became nightmarish with intent. Dark trees clutched at him, drew nails across his cheeks and shoulders. Unseen rocks kicked at his sandaled toes. The ringed moon laid him bare. Thought slurred into thought. He spat blood continually. The path before him, shadowy and granular, rolled beneath his staggering legs. A greater dark unfolded through the night, and he passed out of memory, wondering, how could souls flicker? Then Serwe was staring down at him. He felt her thighs beneath his neck, firm and warm through her linen tunic. She leaned forward and her breast brushed his temple. She retrieved a water skin, used it to wet a rag. She had been tending to the cuts on his face. She smiled, and a ragged breath stole through him. There was such sanctuary in the lap of woman. A stillness that made the world, with all its threshing fury, seem small instead of encompassing, errant instead of essential. He winced as she dabbed a cut above his left eye. He savored the sense of cool water warming against his skin. The black plate of night was beginning to gray. Looking up, he saw the faint nimbus of hair about her jaw. He reached up to brush it, but hesitated. When he glimpsed the scabs across his knuckles, he became alarmed. Though the pain of his wounds lay like a weight upon him, he jerked himself upright, coughed, and spat a mouthful of bloody sputum. They sat upon a grassy round on the summit of some hill. The east warmed to the unseen sun. Ridgelines wandered across the intervening miles, dark with vegetation, pale with nude stone faces.
I'm forgetting something, he said.
She nodded and smiled the blithe and jubilant way she always did when she knew some answer.
The one you hunt, she said. The murderer.
He felt his face darken.
But I am the murderer, the most violent of all men. They slouch forward in chains. They ape their fathers, just as their fathers aped their fathers before them, all the way back to the beginning. Covenants of earth, covenants of blood. I stood and found my chains were smoke. I turned and saw the void. I am unfettered.
She studied him for a moment, her perfect face poised between thought and moonlight.
Yes, like the one you hunt.
What were these shallow creatures?
You call yourself my lover? You think yourself my proof, my prize?
She blinked in dread and sorrow.
Yes.
But you are a knife. You are a spear and hammer. You are nepenthe, opium. You would make a haft of my heart and brandish me. Brandish me!
And me, a masculine voice said. What of me? One of her brothers had sat to his right, only it wasn't one of her brothers, it was him. The serpent whose coils ever tightened about his heart. Moengus, the murderer, wearing the armor and insignia of a Nansor infantry captain. Or was he Kellis?
You!
The Dunyane nodded, and the air became yaksh dank, yaksh sour. What am I?
I...
What kind of madness? What kind of devilry?
Tell me,
Moengus said. How long had he hidden in Shima? How long had he prepared? It did not matter. It did not matter. Nayor would crack open the sun with his hate. He would carve out its heart and bury all the world in endless black.
Tell me, what do you see?
The one,
Nayor grated,
that I hunt.
Yes,
Serwe said from behind him.
The murderer.
He murdered my father with words, consumed my heart with revelation.
Yes.
He set me free.
Nayor turned back to Serwe, filled with a longing so great it seemed his chest must implode. Crevasses opened across her forehead, cheek, and chin. Knuckled limbs reared from the perfect planes of her outer face. With a gentle tug, they pulled their tips apart. Her lips vanished. She leaned forward with a slow, encompassing ardor. Limbs, long and gracile, drew back, stretched outward, then clasped the back of his skull. As though within a fist, she held him tight to her hot mouth, her true mouth. He drew his legs beneath him, then effortlessly hoisted her into his banded arms. So light, the dawn sun flashed across their intertwined forms.
Come, Moengus said. The track awaits us. We must run down our prey.
In the distance they heard horns. Nansur horns. Knowing Confis would spare nothing to capture them, they rode as far as they could press their horses, heeding the cycles of exhaustion rather than those of sun, moon, and stars. According to the creatures, Confis had sent a column south of Joktha immediately after debarking. His plan relied on the Holy War's ignorance, and since Saban was certain to discover his treachery, Confis needed to bar all the ways between Karaskand and Zerash. This meant that the Nansor lay both behind and before their small party. The best they could do was strike due south, slipping across Anath Pania, then work their way eastward through the Betmula, where the terrain would make interdiction unlikely and pursuit difficult. Occasionally, Nayor spoke to them, learned something of their lean ways. They called themselves the last children of the Inkoroi, though they were loath to speak of their old fathers. They claimed to be keepers of the inverse fire, though the merest question regarding either their keeping or their fire pitched them into confusion. They never complained, save to say they hungered for unspeakable congress, or to insist they were falling, always falling. They declared he could trust them, because their old father had made them his slaves. They were, they said, dogs that would sooner starve than snap meat from a stranger's hand. They carried, Nayor could see, the spark of the void within them, like the Srank. As a child, Nayor had been fascinated by trees. Given their rarity on the steppe, he only saw them in the winter months, when the Utamat moved their camp into the Swarut, the highlands that bounded the sea the Inrithi called Jorua. Sometimes he would stare at the bare trees for so long, they would lose their radial dimensions and seem something flat, like blood smeared into the wrinkles about an old woman's eyes. Men were like this, Nayor realized, binding their manifold roots, then branching in 1,000 different directions, twining into the greater canopy of other men. But these things, these skin spies, were something altogether different, though they could mimic men well enough. They did not bleed into their surroundings as men did. They struck through circumstances, rather than reaching out to claim them. They were spears concealed in the thickets of human activity, thorns, tusks. And this lent them a curious beauty, a dread elegance. They were simple in the way of knives, these skin spies. He envied them that, even as he loved and pitied.
2 centuries ago I was Skilvendi, it said once. I know your ways.
Who else have you been?
I have been many.
And now?
I am Serwe, your lover.
The determination of Confess's pursuit became evident the third night of their southward flight. Along the Anathpanean frontier, they crossed hills arranged like longitudinal dunes, with sharp, wandering ridgelines and steep slip faces. Everything was green, but in the way of tenacious rather than lush things. Carp grasses choked the clearings, thronging along the cracks of even the sheerest of escarpments. Thickets of catclaw thatched the slopes, and stands of carob dominated many of the valleys, though it was too early in the year for them to offer any forage. At dusk, while filing along the crest of one of these hills, Nayor saw several dozen fires winking orange on a flat top some miles to the north. The nearness of the fires didn't surprise him. If anything, he was comforted by the distance. The Nansur, he knew, had intentionally chosen the highest ground possible, hoping to spook them into pressing their horses too hard. It was the numbers that troubled him. If they had tracked them this far, they knew their party hadn't fled to Karaskand to shelter with Sauban, which meant they knew Nayor meant to cleave east at some point. Whoever commanded the pursuit had likely already dispatched bands to the southeast in hopes of cutting them off. It would be like shooting arrows in the dark, certainly, but his quiver looked deep. Over the course of the following day, they encountered an Anathi goatherd. The old fool surprised them, and before Nayor could utter a word, Serwe had killed him. The soil was too rocky to effectively bury the man, so they were forced to tie the body to one of the spare horses, which, of course, further tired the beast. Even then, the vultures, which forever soared the margins of the world and the outside, found and followed them. With vultures circling, they might as well have carried a banner as high as the clouds. That night, they paused in one of the valleys, and though the sky was clear and moonbright, they burned the body. They continued across the rugged Anathpanean countryside for a week, avoiding all signs of men, save for one meager village which they plundered for sport and supplies. For 2 consecutive nights, the skies were overcast and the darkness impenetrable. Nayor cooked his blade in a small fire, then scarred his shoulders and chest with the lives he had taken at Jaktha. He avoided looking at Serwe and the other 2 creatures who sat opposite, as silent and watchful as leopards. When he finished, he raved at them, only to weep in remorse afterward. There had been no judgment in their eyes, he realized, no humanity. On no fewer than 3 different nights, they saw the fires of what had to be their Nansur pursuers, and though it seemed to Nayor they were more distant each time, he was not heartened. It was a strange thing, fleeing the pursuit of unseen men. Things unseen could not be pinned with the foibles and debilities that made men mere men. They lay unfixed and restless in the soul. As such, They had the habit of expanding into principle, into something that transcended the mundane world and lorded over it. Each time Nayor saw the fires of the Nansor, they seemed markers of something greater. And even though he was the one who rode with abominations, it seemed all obscenity lay on the horizon behind him. The north became despotic, the west tyrannical. They wandered, red-eyed, exchanging moon-pale landscapes for sunbright, and Nayor fell to reckoning the oddities of his soul. He supposed he was insane, though the more he pondered the word, the more uncertain its meaning became. On several occasions he had presided over the ritual throat-cutting of Utamut pronounced insane by the tribal elders. According to the memorialists, men went feral in the manner of dogs and horses, and in like manner had to be put down. The Enrithi, he knew, thought insanity the work of demons. One night, during the infancy of the Holy War, and for reasons Nayor could no longer recall, the sorcerer had taken a crude parchment map of the three seas and pressed it flat over a copper laver filled with water. He had poked holes of varying sizes through the parchment, and when he held his oil lantern high to complement the firelight, little beads of water glinted across the tanned landscape. Each man, he explained, was a kind of hole in existence, a point where the outside penetrated the world. He tapped one of the beads with his finger. It broke, staining the surrounding parchment. When the trials of the world broke men, he explained, the outside leaked into the world. This, he had said, was madness. At the time, Nayor had been less than impressed. He had despised the sorcerer, thinking him one of those mewling souls who forever groaned beneath burdens of their own manufacture. He had dismissed all things him out of hand. But now, the force of his demonstration seemed indisputable. Something other inhabited him. It was peculiar. Sometimes it seemed that each of his eyes answered to a different master, that his every look involved war and loss. Sometimes it seemed he possessed two faces, an honest outer expression which he sunned beneath the open sky, and a more devious inner countenance. If he concentrated, he could almost feel its muscles, deep, twitching webs of them, beneath the musculature that stretched his skin. But it was elusive, like the presentiment of hate in a brother's glance, and it was profound, sealed like marrow within living bone. There was no distance, no way to frame it within his comprehension, and how could there be? When it thought, he was. The bead had been broken, there could be no doubt of that. According to the sorcerer, madness all came down to the question of origins. If the divine possessed him, he would be some kind of visionary or prophet, if the demonic. The sorcerer's demonstration seemed indisputable. It accorded with his nagging intuitions. It explained, among other things, the strange affinities between madness and insight, why the soothsayers of one age could be the bedlamites of another. The problem, of course, was the Dunyain. He contradicted all of it. Nayor had watched him ply the roots of man after man and thus command their branching actions, nursing their hatred, cultivating their shame and their conceit, nurturing their love, herding their reasons, breeding their beliefs, and all with nothing more than mundane word and expression. Nothing more than worldly things. The Dunyain, Nayor realized, acted as though there were no holes in the sorcerer's parchment map, no beads to signify souls, no water to mark the outside. He assumed a world where the branching actions of one man could become the roots of another, and with this elementary assumption he had conquered the acts of thousands. He had conquered the Holy War. This insight sent Nayor reeling, for it suddenly seemed that he rode through two different worlds, one open, where the roots of men anchored them to something beyond, and another closed, where those selfsame roots were entirely contained. What would it mean to be mad in such a closed world? But such a world could not be, ingrown and insensate,
cold and soulless. There had to be more. Besides, he couldn't be mad, he decided, because he possessed no origins. He had kicked free of all Earth. He didn't even possess a past. Not really. What he remembered, he always remembered now. He, Neyur Ur-Skiotha, was the ground of what came before. He was his own foundation. Laughing, he thought of the Dunyane and how, upon their fatal reunion, this would overthrow him. He tried, once, to share these ruminations with Serwe and the others, but they could offer him only the simulacrum of understanding. How could they fathom his depths when they themselves possessed none? They were not bottomless holes in the world as he was. They were animate, yet they did not live, not truly. They, he realized with no little horror, had no souls. They dwelt utterly within the world. And for no reason, his love of them, his love of her, became all the more fierce. Several more days passed before they sighted the first true peaks of the Betmula, though Neyur suspected they had crossed out of Anathpania sometime earlier. They made toward them, intending to traverse the great sloping aprons piled across their northern faces. They crossed a rugged tableland, then followed the winding course of a braided stream, riding beneath the bowers of water birches. As the mountains loomed ever greater and darker above them, Neyur could not help but recall the Hethantus and his harsh use of Serwe. He had been a fool then, a free man trying to make himself a slave of his people, but he knew not the words that would make her understand.
"Our child," he called lamely, "was conceived in mountains like these."
When she said nothing, he cursed himself and the sensitivities of women. Later that afternoon, one of their horses was lamed, descending a slope of earth and shale. They left it behind, rather than put it down, for fear of vultures giving their path away. Leading their mounts, they continued long into the darkness, exploiting the preternatural sight of the skin spies. Barring disaster, there was no way the fires behind them, no matter how dread their abstraction, could hope to overtake them. Come morning, the ramps of the Betmula towered into the southwestern sky. They came across a dead lake, its depth swollen with crimson algal blooms. Not far away, on a promontory rising from a pure stand of canyon oak, they found the ruined footings of some shrine. Faceless forms jutted from the rolling carpets of fallen leaves. An artesian spring trickled from the altar, and they refilled their skins. Some kind of deer grazed the slopes about the lake, and with great mirth, Neyur watched Serwe and her brothers run a juvenile down on foot alone. Afterward, he stumbled across some cousin of Orpin while making mud in the brush. The tubers, though far from ready, tasted delicious with the venison. Their fire, as small as it was, proved a mistake. The wind was blowing directly from the west, across the lake. The skin spies smelled them first, but far too late. "They come," Serwe said suddenly, looking to her brothers. Within a heartbeat, it seemed, the two of them vanished into the canopy's recesses. Then Neyur heard the distinctive snort and chop of horses laboring up a humus slope, the clink and clatter of gear filtering through the gloomy interior of the wood. Knowing Serwe would follow, he sprinted up to the flat foundation of the shrine. The first of the Kidrahil cleared the oaks just as he turned upon the lip. They began hooting when they caught sight of him. Dozens materialized behind them, their uncaparisoned mounts, throwing spittle from their bits as they worked their heads up and down. The Kidrahil in the forward ranks drew their long swords. A shriek pealed through the trees. Neyur saw cavalrymen yank on their reins, wheel their mounts about in confusion. He saw one fall, a crimson smear where his face should be. They were looking up now, shouting in alarm. Then Neyur glimpsed them. The brothers, sweeping down and out of the layered canopy, scooping up lives every time. The rearmost Kidrahil were panicking now. To a man, those galloping toward him were looking over their shoulders, veering to their right as they slowed. Neyur could hear an officer shouting, "Out of the trees! Out of the trees!"
But his men needed no encouragement. They were already pounding across the smoking campsite, riderless horses scattered in all directions. Then Neyur noticed the bows, recurved like the Skilvendi, drawn from lacquered leather cases set low and back on their saddles, also just like the Skilvendi. Renewing their shouts, the Kidrahil fanned back up the slope, guiding their mounts with spur and knee. The first three drew and released, raising and lowering their bows in the draw, again just like the people. Serwe swept her arms in front of him, batting the first shaft from his path, ignoring the second, which whistled past him, and catching the third in the meat of her forearm. Stunned, Neyur stepped back, fell to one knee. There was no cover.
"Serwe!" he cried.
The Kidrahil had split into two streams, one to each side of the shrine. Instinctively, Neyur scrambled to the back left corner of the ancient platform, crouched low, using the angles to shield himself from one band while exposing himself to the other. Almost immediately, the riders to his left galloped into view, yelling, "Hoop, hoop, hoop!" to their horses, raising their bows. Somehow Serwe was in front of him. For an instant, she stood, a poised beauty, arms out, flaxen hair gleaming in the mountain sun. She danced for him, shielding, leaping, striking. She kept her back turned to him as though in observance of some ritual modesty. Her sleeves snapped like leather. Shafts clattered across the platform. Others buzzed about his shoulders and head. She dipped, rolled her arms about. A shaft appeared in the palm of her hand. She kicked, swung her heel down from her raised knee. A shaft jutted from her calf. The fletching of two more materialized in her back. She cartwheeled, kicked an arrow away even as three others thudded into her chest and abdomen. She cycled her hands outward, batted away four in succession, threw her head back, thrust out her arms, caught one in the back of her right hand, another in her left forearm. She jerked her head to the left. An arrowhead popped from the back of her neck. She whimpered, as a little girl might. But she never ceased moving. Blood flew out in beads and lines, flashed in arcs beneath the sun. Meanwhile, the chorus of shouts and cries grew louder and louder. A horn pealed out, then was cut short. But Neyur could see nothing save her dance. Limbs lithe and pale beneath threads of crimson, pierced and weeping, the linen of her shift taut and bloody about her swaying breasts. Serwe, his prize. The cries faltered. Hooves rumbled down the slopes. She stopped. As though preparing for prayer, she slumped to one knee. She craned her head forward, silently gagging. She raised a pierced arm, snapped the birch shaft in her mouth. Her motions were deliberate, stiff. She reached back, fumbled for the arrowhead jutting from the base of her skull, pulled the shaft clear on a stream of blood. Then she turned to look at him. Her smiling eyes shimmered with tears. She tried to wipe at the blood pulsing from her lips, only to scratch her neck with the arrow piercing her hand. She looked at him unpuzzled, then slouched forward across the platform. Neyur heard the pop of buried wood.
"Serwe!"
he cried. When he shook her, her perfect face fell apart. Numb, desolate, he stood, stared in horror at the carnage across the slopes. The brothers stood amid the dead Nansur, watching him without expression. Both had several arrows buried in their limbs, but they seemed unconcerned. Over a dozen riderless horses wandered the near distance, but he could see no sign of the Kidrahil.
"We must bury her,"
he called. Serwe helped him.